Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are you afraid of? Snakes and heights and public speaking might seem downright pleasant to you after you read Richard Preston's latest work. He's collected strange but true stories of some of the most vexing mysteries of modern science, and the often even stranger researchers who obsess over solving them. His new book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. Richard, welcome back to Think.
Hello, Chris.
So you revisit the scourge of Ebola in this book, which is just as deadly as ever, just about as unpredictable. And scientists are still looking for clues about the natural host. What can we surmise from the evidence that exists now?
Well, that's a great question and a fascinating mystery. Ebola virus lives naturally in some animal in equatorial Africa. It may be a rodent, or an animal can be an insect, a butterfly, a bat. There's a little bit of evidence that maybe certain species of bats harbor it, and there's some evidence that the Ebola virus lives in some unknown species that lives in the forest canopy high above the ground where it rarely comes in contact with people. But every now and then, Ebola virus, the natural host of Ebola, somehow comes in contact with a person, and the virus can leap from its natural host into its new host, a human being, in a process known as the trans-species jump. And from there, it can move in a human-to-human chain of lethal transmission.
You know, one thing that's really striking reading that chapter is how incredibly courageous many scientists are. There are those who are studying these things in the lab, but especially those practicing in the field, doctors and nurses and people who put their lives at risk every single day.
I love writing about scientists who put their lives on the line for human knowledge or to save lives. When Ebola virus breaks out, it often breaks out in areas where there just isn't very good medical care at all. The hospitals are incredibly under-equipped. And I tell a story in Panic in Level 4 about a Belgian doctor who was in the midst of an Ebola outbreak. It was actually the first recorded outbreak in Congo in 1976. He was in a hospital that had been completely sacked by Ebola virus. Most of the medical staff was dead, and many patients were dead. The operating rooms were strewn with puddles of Ebola-infected blood. And in the midst of all this, he got a patient, a woman who was in childbirth. She was ill, and she was trying to deliver a baby, and the baby was stuck. The doctor didn't have access to anesthetics, and so he used a scalpel to cut her pelvis. And when the bones of the pelvis spring apart that way, he was then able to remove the baby. He discovered the baby was drenched with blood and had gone into breathing arrest. So without thinking, in the emergency of the moment, he put his mouth to the baby's mouth and gave the baby life resuscitation and got it breathing again. But then when he pulled the baby away from him, his mouth and face were covered with blood. And there was a nurse standing by who said, "Doctor, do you realize what you've done?" And he said, "I do now." They forget themselves.
And it's such an interesting story because when you first covered that, I guess you just assumed that that doctor had then died.
Yes. And in fact, the story was told to me by a medical doctor named William Close, who's the father of the actress Glenn Close. He ran the biggest hospital in Congo. And we were closing this article for the New Yorker magazine in kind of very stressed circumstances, and when we got it done, it went immediately to the printing plant. And as I hung up the phone with Dr. Close, I suddenly realized that I had forgotten to ask him, well, what happened to that Belgian doctor? And when I talked with Dr. Close years later, I said, Bill, whatever happened to that doctor? How long did he survive? And Close started laughing, and he said, well, about 30 years as of today. He's one of my closest friends. I ended up talking with him, and I found out, in fact, that the woman had not had Ebola virus. She'd had malaria. It had masked the symptoms of Ebola.
Would you describe for us U.S. AMRID, which is the facility where government scientists study the scariest diseases, including Ebola?
Sure. USAMRID, United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. The scientists who work there call it the Institute. It is in Fort Detrick, Maryland, about an hour's drive outside our nation's capital. And there, in specially equipped biocontainment buildings and zones, which are called hot zones or hot areas, researchers who are clothed in fully, they're garbed in fully protective pressurized spacesuits, work with and do research on so-called hot agents, which are level four, that's the highest level of lethality, level four hot agents for which there is no vaccine and no known cure. You go into a hot zone through an airlock door, actually a double steel door with an airlock and chemical shower in between the two doors. So I ended up going into level four when I was working on a book, The Hot Zone, and I had some interesting experiences inside, including my spacesuit malfunctioned, blew apart, and I found myself unprotected face-to-face with an unknown level 4 X virus, a virus that they were trying to characterize.
And at that point, you thought to yourself, what in the world am I doing here?
Yeah, you know, as journalists, you know, you immediately what's going through my mind is, you stinking idiot, what are you doing? Also, I was, you know, panicking, but trying not to panic.
And that's the title, right? Panic in level 4.
Panic in level 4 is that moment in level 4 when I in fact came face-to-face with a level 4 virus, apparently. We don't really know, because the virus itself was never fully characterized. What happened was that I was working at the time on trying to describe a nonfiction true event in The Hot Zone, the book, when Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Jacks gets a breach in her spacesuit in those very rooms that I was in, and she's working with Ebola blood, and the blood runs inside her spacesuit, and she's got a cut on her hand with a Band-Aid over it. She had been opening a can of beans for her kids the night before, cooking for her children, and now she was thinking that she could die of Ebola. And so when she was standing in the airlock shower with the chemicals running over her spacesuit, wondering whether she had Ebola blood in there and whether it was going to get into her bloodstream through the cut, thoughts were streaming through her mind, which I reported in the book. And I found, I've never told this story before, but I found myself in exactly the same situation while I was researching the book, standing in the chemical shower, having had a breach in my spacesuit in the Ebola hot zone, and wondering what would come next.
And what, everybody seems to be afraid, first and foremost, of having to be quarantined.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. What Nancy Jacks told me was, and it rang so true, I said to her, were you afraid of dying of Ebola? And she said, no, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about, if they had to put me in the isolation hospital, the slammer, I was thinking, well, who's going to pay the babysitter? I forgot to go to the bank today, and Jerry, her husband, is off in Texas. Oh, no, you know, what's going to happen if I'm breaking with Ebola? She was a mother, and she was thinking first about her children. And it was a poignant statement about mothers, love, children, and death. And I found myself, unfortunately, in the very same situation. I have three kids. And I was standing in the chemical shower thinking, oh, no, you know, if I'm in isolation and I'm breaking with Ebola, my poor kids, what's going to happen to them?
Well, the great thing about the stories in this book and really all of your work is that you're writing about science, but really you're writing about people. You're writing about scientists and sort of their, or people who are affected by science. There's one really interesting chapter in the book about the Chudnovsky brothers. Can you talk about them?
Yeah, I love people. Scientists who go on obsessive quests. The act of writing about these people is itself an obsessive quest. There are times when I feel that, you know, I ought to have my head examined. Why am I writing about these people? Who would ever want to know about them? But on the other hand, they are perfectly fascinating. These two guys, Gregory and David Chudnovsky, are mathematicians who live in New York City. They claim that they are a single mathematician who just by chance happens to occupy two human bodies. Gregory, the younger brother, suffers from a wasting disease that keeps him in bed most of the time or in a wheelchair. When they walk around, they often walk together because his brother supports him when they walk. They seem almost like conjoined twins. In their apartment in New York, they built a supercomputer out of mail-order parts. It's one of the most powerful supercomputers for its time in the world. The younger brother, Gregory Chudnovsky, is actually a genius. He's one of the world's leading designers of advanced supercomputers. He designs them in his head, the way Mozart wrote music in his head. So they had this computer, and they were using it to calculate the number pi to more than 2 billion decimal places. Pi, if you remember math, is the ratio of the diameter of a circle to its circumference. And it, if you put it in digits, it's 3.1415963, and it goes on to infinity. It never ends, and the digits never repeat. An endless sentence of digits written into the nature of this incredibly important ratio in mathematics. These guys were analyzing these digits, looking for signs of hidden order or patterns in pi that would in effect be a glimpse of the face of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's really amazing about this chapter is that you have to then once again come to this wondrous nature of pi. It's what's called a transcendental number.
Oh, it's so weird and interesting. A transcendental number is a number that runs to infinity in digits and never repeats. It doesn't have any visible pattern. Some transcendental numbers do have very visible patterns, but they're just not repetitions. They're just patterns. For example, here's a transcendental number, 1.12233344455666, and so on forever and ever and ever. This is a pattern. It's a very kind of simple pattern, but it's a number that cannot be expressed in any other form than running those digits out. There's no way that you can express any transcendental number like pi with any finite mathematics. You can't represent pi in an algebraic equation or a statement that isn't infinite.
Well, and it's a great way to get our minds around the concept of infinity. You write that if we assigned every letter to a number combination, we would eventually get random accidental combinations of every sentence ever uttered, every book ever written, just by random chance.
Sure. The Chudnovsky brothers calculated the largest possible supercomputer that could be built in the universe. It would be a supercomputer made out of all the atoms in the universe, and it would be 10 to the 79th atoms. That is a 10 followed by 79 zeros. But even a machine made of the entire universe would still not be able to calculate very much pi at all because pi is infinite. So the worry is that there is certainly a pattern in pi, but many mathematicians feel that in principle in our universe we'll never be able to see it because we can't build a computer large enough to find it.
What would change if we knew pi?
Well, I think if we were to find a pattern in pi, or rather, I should say, if we were to find the pattern in pi, because pi is definitely an ordered number. It's definitely patterned. It's just that we humans can't see the pattern. If we were to find the pattern, it would be an exceedingly important discovery. It would tell us very deep things about the relationship of the circle to numbers themselves.
Hmm. Yeah, you write that it's extraordinary that the language of mathematics fits the laws of physics.
Yeah. A physicist once remarked that it is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve that nature somehow knows mathematics.
Richard Preston is my guest. His new book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. We will get to some more of those inner journeys and outer journeys in just a moment. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
Yeah. You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Richard Preston. His new book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. You have a chapter in the book, Richard, about this syndrome that causes people to injure others, and especially themselves, in really bizarre ways. Can you talk about its symptoms?
Yeah, this is very strange. This is the so-called self-cannibalism disease. Its technical name is the Lesch-Nyhan syndrome. It's named after two doctors who discovered it in 1962 in Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. A little boy was brought in, and he had chewed off portions of his fingers, chewed off his lips, and was engaging in very subtle and spectacular forms of self-injury or self-sabotage. We now know that the disease is caused by the alteration of a single letter in the human DNA. The human DNA has 3.2 billion letters of code. That's about the equivalent of 6,000 copies of Moby Dick. If you take one page out of that, all those Moby Dicks, and change one letter on a certain page, the person develops into a compulsive self-cannibal. There's nothing these people can do about this. It is a genetic disease, so you're born with it. It's very rare in the U.S., and it afflicts almost entirely boys. When the boy is born, the baby is normal for about the first 6 months, and then at about 6 months, when he cuts his first teeth, he begins using them to bite his hands and fingers, to bite them off, and to bite his lips off, to bite his tongue off. These people try to pull their eyes out by their roots, and I ended up getting to know two people with the disease, two adults, two guys, became friends with them. It took me something like 7 years to write this because I just couldn't find my way into the mind of a self-cannibal and find a way to write about them as human beings without sort of making them look like freaks. The disease itself is a kind of Rosetta Stone for human behavior. While we know exactly what's wrong with the genes of this person, we can actually do the code and look at the change in the single letter. What we don't know is how that biochemical defect feeds into this dramatic alteration of behavior in the brain. If we did know, as I said, it would be a kind of Rosetta Stone, we might find out very interesting and powerful things about all human behavior. All human behavior has a little bit of a touch of self-cannibalism in it. We all have a touch of Lesch-Nyhan syndrome, I would say.
We bite our fingernails. We things like
yes,
that.
Yes. Everybody engages in self-sabotage. That is, we all do things that occasionally injure ourselves, and we regret it, but we can't seem to control it. So, for example, I was talking to one of the scientists who studies Lesch-Nyhan, and he said, you know, think about the fact that many people bite their fingernails and they say they can't stop it. Other people bite their cuticles until they bleed and they say they can't stop it. Other people, when they're nervous, they bite their lips. He said, now imagine that as a kind of a feedback loop involving certain areas of the brain that I'll tell you about. And imagine that as an amplifier. Now turn the volume way up until the feedback is just screaming and you have a person with Lesch-Nyhan syndrome.
And you write that you really liked these guys that you met very much, despite the fact that you yourself got hurt by them a couple of times.
Oh, yeah, I got beaten up on occasion. They're in wheelchairs, but they have a wicked left hook or an uppercut.
What did you like about them?
Well, they're wonderful people. They had an enormous dignity and a kind of nobility that is given to few. I mean, when the very worst thing that could possibly happen to you happens to you, that is, if you are born with a gene that makes you cannibalize your own body, and yet you can derive pleasure out of life, you can have very strong human relationships. These people, for years and years, they were considered to be mentally retarded, but they are not. They simply have difficulty expressing themselves. As one doctor said to me, it's very hard to measure the IQ of someone who has a compulsion to rip up the paper when they put it in front of him. So I found out that they were, you know, people, and they told me about what it was like. And I saw instances of very bizarre self-injury. For example, a person with this disease will tell you yes when he means no. So I'm walking along a street with one of these guys in a wheelchair, and we came to a place where you had to turn left or right. And he said, turn left. So I started to turn left, and then he yelled, "No, no, turn right." So I began turning right. Then he said, "No, no, no, left, left." So finally I turned left. Well, left went through a gate, and as we went through the gate, his hand lashed out, and he hit the gate with his hand. He had set me up to injure himself. And then he apologized profusely afterwards. "Sorry, sorry, not your fault."
Wow. It's hard to even understand what that would be like.
Yeah, another one of these guys, a man named James Elrod, who lives in Santa Cruz, who's a buddy. You know, whenever I'm out there, I see him. He cut his nose off with a fork. And the way he described it to me, he was institutionalized at the time in a state hospital. And these people have to have attendance 24/7, or their hands go out of control. An attendant who was inexperienced left him alone for less than a minute. And his left hand, which he said is his evil hand, the bad hand, picked up a fork and cut his nose off with it. He showed me, at one point I saw his hands. You know, they're very embarrassed about the way their hands look. And James wore Kevlar gloves to protect his hands from biting them.
That's the material that bulletproof vests are made out of.
It's the material that bulletproof vests are made of. In fact, they were motorcycle gloves with Kevlar reinforcement inside them. And we had to take the gloves off, an attendant and I. And we got the gloves off, one hand, and he got this glittering look in his eye, which is the Lesch-Nyhan look that people who know this disease talk about. His mouth opened, and then his hand began to move toward his mouth. He had bitten off one finger, and the rest of the fingers were chewed almost to the bone. And then he said, "Help, help, stop it." And it took all of our strength to keep his hand from going into his mouth. He wanted it to stop, and he experienced pain just the way you and I would. And he was absolutely terrified of these episodes of self-cannibalism. So, and seeing that afterwards, when we got the gloves back on him, he calmed down. And then he said to me, "I wanted you to see that. Every day I'm hoping for a cure."
Hmm. Well, the fact that this is a genetic condition leads nicely into talking about Craig Venter, who is the first man to have mapped the human genome, and it happened to be his own genome. You were warned ahead of time by many people about the sort of person he was, that he was arrogant and not very nice and sort of devious. I have to say, we had him on the show, and I was also warned that he was not very nice, but he seemed to have been on his best behavior at that point.
Well, Craig Venter is a really great figure in the history of science, in American science. And actually, I happen to like him immensely. I think you either hate Craig Venter or you really like him. I like him. He's one of those people who simply doesn't control his mouth very well, and he says what he thinks, but he's absolutely brilliant, and he's typically right. He's an iconoclast. So he set out in 2000 to do the first complete sequence of the human DNA, to read the human book of life and decode all the letters in the human DNA. The human DNA exists, or the so-called human genome exists, in every cell in our bodies, spooled up in the chromosomes at the center of the cell. So you can take any cell from a human body, and you can read the entire human book of life out of that cell. So Venter ended up in competition with a publicly funded project called the Human Genome Project that had soaked up billions and billions of taxpayer dollars attempting to map the human genome, but they weren't finished with the work yet. Craig Venter got involved with a company, Celera Genomics, and he said that he was going to do it with his company and with private money, investors' money, and he was going to do it faster at less than 10% of the government cost to the taxpayer, at no cost to the taxpayer. Well, the Human Genome Project, as you can imagine, the leaders of it got really, really incensed. One of them was James Watson, who was the person who received the Nobel Prize for discovering the nature of DNA in 1953.
The shape of the double helix.
The shape of the double helix. And Venter and James Watson got into a real, almost a kind of a high noon showdown. And I kind of love, I love writing about scientists who are, after all, as human and fallible as everybody else. And I love to write about this mixture of these grand visions and dreams and these very important achievements. But these all together two human motivations that sometimes guide scientists.
Well, it's funny because to read this, Richard, you really do have almost two stories. You've got this competitive nonsense and hubris and rudeness on the level of, you know, 9-year-old boys. And then running right alongside that, you have this extraordinary, pure, entirely valid scientific achievement. Do you find that those parallels are typical to scientists? Are they unique to scientists in their magnitude?
That's a great question, Chris. No, of course not. It's very common with artists, too. Ernest Hemingway was said to be an absolutely obnoxious, distasteful human being. The Sun Also Rises, his great novel, is a beautiful, sensitive book. But the man who wrote it was anything but sensitive. He was really kind of a walking shambles, not anybody you'd like to meet. I mean, he once beat up the poet Ezra Pound in a fist fight. We're all human. But there is... I feel something very deep about this, which is that there is a nobility to the very human enterprise. You know, with all our flaws, we are gifted with sentience, with self-awareness. It's a great and incredible gift given to no other species that we actually know of. I'm sure that the universe is filled with sentience, with living creatures who are as self-aware as we are, but we just haven't met them yet. And I love the gifts that we've been given also can be our greatest horrors. Biotechnology is the most powerful science of our time. It has superseded physics now. But when great advances and great powers are awakened in a scientific area, great weapons are awakened, and they are sure to follow. I feel that it is only a matter of time before genetic engineering may be used for dark purposes in dark biology to create weapons of mass destruction that would be genetically engineered organisms that would be very, very difficult to combat with vaccines or drugs.
Richard Preston is my guest. His new book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Chris. I wanted to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Preston, I wanted to thank you for starting my interest and passion in biological weapons of mass destruction in your first book, The Hot Zone. I just think you're a wonderful writer, and you lead a lot of young kids into science with your ability to just let everybody take a grasp of it and bring out the scientist in each and every one of them.
Thanks, Patrick.
I wanted to ask you just three quick questions, the first of which follows what you just said about dark biology.
Hang on a second, Patrick. We've got a lot of people on the line, so
one quick question.
Okay, thanks.
Falata is a disease that is actually a weapon that was created or talked about in Judith Miller's book, Germs, by the Russian vector or biopreparative that makes their biological weapons of mass destruction, which causes myelin sheathing in the body to actually attack itself.
Yikes, that is really scary.
I was wondering and they also talk in that book about viruses that cause behavioral modifications, as you were talking about with the self-cannibalization. The political scientist Francis Fukuyama predicts in the future that level 4 biocontainment facilities will be decreased in size and be able to put in random places around the world, in third world countries, to create strategic weapons. I want to know what you think
about
that.
Sure, let me see if I can comment on that. Well, first of all, there's a lot of evidence that countries have already begun this kind of work, and certainly revelations about what happened in the old Soviet Union, where the Soviet bioweaponeers were doing dark experiments. I think some of their work, the Soviet work, was a little bit loony. I don't think that it necessarily went anywhere effective in terms of weapons. But one of the concerns I have is that there could be lots of countries around the world experimenting with bioweapons, but they're not using good biocontainment. They don't have the money for these really sophisticated level 4 labs. And so there's a danger, I think, of an accidental release of an organism from a laboratory in a developing nation.
Scary stuff. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Brian in Colleyville. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the show. Your guest mentioned two things earlier, and I kind of combined the two, and it brought a question to my mind. First, he was talking about the search for patterns in pi, and then second, he mentioned how some physicists comment about how amazing it is that nature knows numbers, And then I started thinking, well, you know, we base our number system on 10 because we have 10 fingers. But has anyone given any thought to looking at looking for pi using a different base, either octal or hex, or even based on, say,
Yes, as a matter of fact, they have. And they found out that pi, no matter what base number system you use, no matter what symbols you use to represent pi, they all do the same thing. They all go to infinity with no apparent pattern or design, even though we know there's a pattern in pi. You know, I was thinking about something that David and Gregory Chudnovsky said to me. I asked them, you know, if they believe in God and if they're Platonists, that is to say, do they believe, as Plato did, that mathematics is a higher form of reality, and in fact, mathematics is a kind of an expression of God? And they said that most mathematicians are probably Platonists. That is, they believe that the universe of mathematics, the world, the great world of numbers and equations, is a more perfect universe than the universe we live in, and so therefore is closer to God.
We have an email from Bill, who writes from Chiang Mai, Thailand, and I'll ask the question and then maybe you can answer it right after our break. But he writes, your guest description of various panic situations brings to mind that sci-fi classic, The Andromeda Strain, which was just redone a couple of weeks ago. He wants to know, what are the possible dangers of bringing back some sort of virus, either intentionally or unintentionally, from space? I guess at this point we haven't found any living thing or anything even like a virus, but certainly the potential is out there. So we will get an answer about that question from Richard Preston in just a moment. The book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Richard Preston. His new book is called Panic in Level 4, Cannibals, Killer Viruses, and Other Journeys to the Edge of Science. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or try us by phone at 1-800-933-5372. So to the question, Richard, about something like the Andromeda Strain, what do you think?
Well, I think I personally think that life exists out there. The universe is a very, very big place. But we haven't seen it. That's the Enrico Fermi, the physicist, the famous Enrico Fermi paradox. He said, where are they? In other words, if the aliens are out there, how come we haven't seen them yet? I'm not terribly worried about an Andromeda strain scenario of alien life form coming and wiping out the human species. And it's because alien biology, exobiology as it's called, would probably be very, very different than our biology. It might use a different form of genetic code, for example. The organisms that are the most dangerous to us are the ones that understand our immune systems very, very well, like smallpox, for example, which is thought to have emerged in the human species about 10,000 years ago. This virus, smallpox, is the most dangerous, deadly virus in human history, killing more people on the planet than the Black Death, for example, of the Middle Ages. Smallpox understands the human immune system beautifully, and when a person becomes infected with smallpox, the first thing that happens is that their immune system becomes deranged in an almost very sophisticated way, and you die of what is called a cytokine storm, a derangement of the immune system. So the stuff that I worry about is the stuff that's right here close to us that knows us too well.
Would it be? It should be that all the threats are far out in space and we'd be better off.
We might be a little better off.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Evan in Dallas. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I just have a question. It seems like we have this imaginary development in science as far as like these viruses and things that go. I just wonder why we don't imagine the ethics behind the science evolving as well. It seems like we used to use human labor, slave labor, but that kind of evolved out of being customary.
Yeah, well, I wonder and have publicly questioned the ethics of developing biological weapons or of not allowing our minds to embrace the possibility of the darkness in the human heart, creating weapons out of medical science. People in biomedical research, they devote their energy to saving human lives, but the knowledge can also be perverted to taking human lives. And I think in general, molecular biologists have not really wanted to think about the possibility that some of their colleagues, particularly in other nations, not in the United States, could be engaging in dark biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? The people that you meet, and you spend a great deal of time typically with your interview subjects, and you describe them in really profound ways. How often do you find them to be, it's sort of a funny question, thinkers, deep thinkers about the ethics in addition to thinking about the science?
Oh, I hear a lot of private worry.
Mm-hmm.
The biologists, though, are also a little bit worried about the government regulating them.
Right, deciding what the ethics
sure.
ought to be.
But they all know that there's a standard cookbook in molecular biology. It's called The Big Red Book. It's a 7 or 12 volume. I don't know how many volumes it is, but it's basically a giant cookbook that has all these protocols or recipes in it for doing all the standard things in molecular biology, inserting genes into various organisms. And this book, which has been used for, you know, immense good, can also be used for evil, because the very techniques of molecular biology are what are called dual use. That is to say, they could be put to the service of weapons. So, is it happening? Are there people out there attempting to create biological weapons, genetically engineered? Certainly, I don't know. I don't even know that our intelligence services have a very good handle on this. It's very hard to trace. As one of your earlier callers pointed out, you can do molecular biology in a very small lab, and for not a whole lot of money. You could probably, for a few $100,000, if you had smallpox virus, you could spend about, maybe $500,000 or less dollars and do gene insertions in smallpox that might make it evasive of the vaccine. In other words, a genetically engineered smallpox used as a terrorist weapon that would simply be proof against the vaccine, the existing vaccine that we have for it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Calvin in Rockwall. Hi, Calvin.
Yes, I got a question. I was back in the military. We had some discussions about smallpox. I can't remember if it was smallpox or polio, but it was engineered as a biological warfare, biological drug by the Japanese. Was it polio or smallpox? I guess that's what I want to ask him.
Yeah, the Japanese, in their infamous bio research unit, I think it was called Unit 9, this was during World War II, were experimenting. They actually weren't doing genetic engineering because that wasn't known back in the 1940s, but they were taking natural organisms, including bubonic plague, and experimenting on humans, giving humans these diseases to see how effective they might be as weapons. And these were dark experiments that involved, deaths of innocent people in the most horrific experiments that were made on them. One interesting little fallout of that Japanese program was that after the war, apparently the Japanese biologists who had been involved in this program were spirited to the United States and debriefed by Americans who at the time wanted us to have a biowarfare program too. The United States did, in fact, have an active biowarfare program. That's offensive biowarfare. That's the development of weapons that could kill people using organisms. And that was ended in 1968 by President Richard Nixon. And to my knowledge, today, the U.S. government does not have any offensive bioweapons research going on. It's We abjured these weapons unilaterally, which was, in fact, a noble thing for our country to do. And instead, we now concentrate on developing defenses against bioweapons that someone might want to use on us.
Yeah, how robust are our biodefense capabilities as compared with what we're trying to do against sort of physical WMDs?
Great question, Chris. Well, you know, we've made some steps in the right direction, but we sure as heck aren't there yet. First of all, these weapons, an infectious disease is very difficult to deal with. A bioweapon is the only weapon that knows how to make copies of itself inside the human body. Not even plutonium can do that. These weapons are alive, or they can be alive, not necessarily, but they can be alive, and they can move from person to person so that they can amplify themselves. It's a self-amplification. So how do you deal with that? Well, what you have to do, what I believe is needed here, is you know, we need to really look hard at the development of new vaccines to protect us against this stuff. And secondly, we need to have much better surveillance. If we don't know what new infectious diseases are moving into the American population, we'll never be able to guard against them or fight them if they come here. And that, of course, if we had better surveillance, we would also know much better what kinds of natural diseases were going around. For example, how many of you have had a kid who developed a really bad cough and it looked like it might be pneumonia? You take the child to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician really can't tell you what is wrong with that child. They can't tell you whether it's a virus or a bacteria. So they load the child up with antibiotics. Might be the right antibiotic or might not, because they don't have any knowledge of actually what is circulating in the community. If we had good public health surveillance, and in fact there is a very good, I'll tell you this, there's a great public health surveillance program going on right now in Lubbock, Texas, where doctors are reporting what they see into a network, into a web-based network, and public health doctors are able to tell docs in Lubbock exactly what's going around the community. So they can say, oh, well, your child has got an adenovirus right now. That's a type of the common cold, but antibiotic isn't going to do any good on that one. So, you know, we'll do other things. You know, of course, a surveillance system like that, which exists in Lubbock, would also be a very good early warning system for the appearance of anthrax or smallpox in a community.
If you were able to sort of scale it much wider than one community.
Oh, well, indeed. I mean, in Lubbock right now, there is 24/7, there is a public health doctor looking at the reports, and one of the things they always check for is anthrax. So people in Lubbock, if, heaven forbid, anthrax ever appears in Lubbock, the docs are going to know about it right away.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Kathy in Dallas. Hi, Kathy.
Good afternoon. I love this show. It's fabulous.
Well, thank you.
My question actually started with a documentary that I was watching, and the subject matter was the origination of AIDS. What they postulated in that documentary was that when, back in the 40s, when they were creating and growing the polio vaccine, they were using monkey kidneys, and there were two main scientists that were working on this kind of in competition with each other, and one of them switched and started using chimpanzee kidneys. And the basic premise of this show was that that is how the AIDS virus was released and made its way into the human population. Is there any accuracy to this at all?
Well, I think it's an open scientific question, and it's fascinating. I tend to think that the preponderance of evidence, but I said it's an open question. I think the preponderance of evidence is that actually AIDS probably was a natural introduction. What they've done is they've studied the DNA, the RNA, which is the genome of the HIV virus. They've studied it very carefully. They've decoded it, and they found that there's a lot of evidence for multiple introductions of HIV into the human species over much of the 20th century. And the introductions seem to have taken place in Central and West Africa, even earlier than the 1950s and 40s. And AIDS may, various strains of AIDS, may have been circulating, smoldering at a very low level in rainforest communities, in small places where people were hunting chimpanzees. And if you think about this, if you think of a chimp that's hunted for meat and then is butchered. The people who butcher the chimp are using sharp knives and tools, and they're getting chimp blood all over their hands, and surely they may occasionally cut themselves accidentally while they're butchering a chimp. So it seems to me that that's a plausible explanation for how the AIDS virus got to the human species. It is seems to be true that HIV originally came from chimpanzees. They have a virus which is very similar to HIV, but it doesn't make them very sick.
Richard, I don't think I've gotten on a plane since the 90s without thinking about a couple of scenes that you have in the Hot Zone. I'm wondering if there are things that you write about that you wish that you could purge from your sort of imagination as you go through your daily life.
Well, you know, I have children and a wife, and I think about these very gloomy things. But I also have to say that I have an innate sense of optimism about where we're going as Americans. And I just wanted to get out and say that. We built an incredible civilization in the face of infectious diseases. Our ancestors, the pioneers who settled North America, lived with smallpox day in and day out. They faced horrific diseases that we no longer have to deal with. And yet they built an incredibly vibrant, free nation in the face of these challenges. And it's certainly true that we face challenges today, and I think some of them are really scary. But I have incredible faith in Americans, in our ability to rise to an occasion and to deal with a crisis if a crisis should arise. We are incredibly innovative. We're very inventive. And we seem to work best in a clutch. I don't think we as Americans respond very well to kind of smoldering problems that seem over the horizon. But when they're in our faces, we are magnificent.
So does that bode well for climate change?
That's a great question. I think climate change looks to be real, and we're going to be dealing with it one way or another. And I think the challenges are going to be immense.
Do you have a favorite unsolved mystery?
I think certainly one of the curious and interesting mysteries is just where does Ebola virus come from? It lives, it hides in some natural host out in the rainforest of equatorial Africa. We don't know where. I have a kind of a feeling, I could be wrong, that it lives in the rainforest canopies up way above the ground. Something like 50% of the species on planet Earth live in treetops and never visit the ground. They're mostly small things, insects, rodents, bats. And if Ebola hides up in the canopy, that would be an explanation for why it rarely gets into humans. Even though it's devastating when it does, it's not a very common outbreak.
Richard
so
Preston.
I love the thought of the rainforest out there, sleeping, dreaming, where biological experiments are going on that we know nothing about in nature.
Richard Preston's new book is called Panic in Level 4. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.